Welcome.
Hey, welcome to this week's Taking It Down. If you're new to us, thanks for listening and joining us. If you're one of our regular listeners, we appreciate you coming back. Two quick notes before we get started. If you'd like to write or produce podcasts in conjunction with the website, by all means, give us a pitch, give us a shout. We welcome all voices. Find us on social media and DM us there, or just email us at thealabamatake@gmail.com. So the second piece of business is, if you are a listener, we've certainly noticed. We've noticed our numbers jumping, and it would be great if you could share us with a friend or on social media, or even give us a starred review online. But getting into today's broadcast, I'm going to be joined, of course, by host Adam Morrow. He and I are going to talk predominantly about the HBO drama I Know This Much Is True, starring Mark Ruffalo in the roles of twin brothers. Then after the break, we're going to focus again predominantly on the Hulu series The Great, which is a send-up about all sorts of socio-political things. It stars Elle Fanning and Nicholas Holt. We might drop some more things in and out of today's podcast. We'll give you a heads up as we approach different topics. So follow along with us. Let's holler at Mr. Adam Morrow and start taking it all down with him. So, Adam, what's up?
What's happening, man? It's, man, Tuesday. This feels weird. What's going on?
I may let you carry the show. I don't have it in me today.
What's happening? Memorial Day took it out of you. It's all that beach sitting you've been doing over the Memorial Day weekend. I know you just went straight for the coast.
It's the idiocy of America that's just killing my vibe.
We're in it. We're deep in it. It was a trying weekend for the nerves, so to speak. But hey, I can't control them. They can't control me.
I guess so.
I'm going to drink my coffee and let them go.
Want to shift gears here, and I do have a general announcement to our listeners and let them know that we've actually reached out to different people of late. And one of them is Rogan O'Connor from The Challenge.
Rogan.
And we heard back from his agent.
Rogan.
That's the man. And the reason why I have not replied to his agent, because I know they're listening. The reason why I haven't replied is because there was, how much time would we need with him? How many listeners do we have? But the key question was, how much do we compensate for guests?
How much do you compensate for your guest host? I haven't seen a lick of it in the mail, if that's the case.
Did you get a direct deposit for $1,200 in the did you get that?
Yeah. Did you orchestrate that?
Yeah.
You send it to the IRS. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, man, this show pays.
That's for a year's worth of work, though. Oh, so I don't know if it pays.
And the 1099 is coming, right? So the government's coming for most of it.
And, we almost have been on for a year. We're approaching June. I think we started in July of last year.
That makes sense. Stranger Things was one of our early topics. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty right on cue there.
Well, let's go. I've got some general notes that I do want to cover before we get into some things. But I mentioned it. Let's bring it. Let's talk about it. You got any thoughts on The Challenge, the most recent episode of the?
We're just going to jump in with The Challenge?
Yeah, dude. Let's start there. Why not?
Start it. All right.
Because I don't have a ton. I thought it was an excellent episode. I was buckled in. I was glued to the screen. I love it. Wednesday nights have become just awesome. I'm so glad you got me back into it. But I don't have any other thoughts other than that. I might chime in, but I'm going to let you ride this horse.
Well, this seemed to be, we talked a bit. If you've read the excellent article that TD's doing every week on the website, you and I kind of chime in with our confessionals there at the bottom. And we talked a bit about maybe frustrations with the format loss, going from like the daily challenge, then a period of house drama, and then an elimination at the end of an episode. So this episode kind of got us back on task with that, which you kind of expected. They built in a little bit extra time for all of the Jenna and Zach drama and the Bear drama and Kayla. All of that took a little extra screen time, but we're back. We're back now. We had a double elimination, and it was a good one. As I said in my confessional there on the website, one of the most frustrating things about this show, if you watch a lot of them, is the wrong competitor getting the wrong elimination at the wrong time. And I think this was one where the matchups were the least compelling that they could have been out of the four dudes on the floor that got called down. And I mean, that all is fair. You know, it's a it's a game, two, it's a reality show game. So it's not like we're I'm crying foul about the International Olympic Committee or something. But I did hate to see Jordan go out in the manner that he went out. That was a bummer. I think he would have had a strong chance of beating most of the guys in the house. Fessy is just a mountain of a dude. And I think even with two good hands, Jordan probably finds a way to at least make that much more competitive. So that was a bummer just on the, if we're talking purely about the elimination. And another note, apparently Jordan, let me get the exact medical language here. That shoulder injury that he suffered was nothing to shake a stick at. Let's see. He separated his collarbone from his AC joint. That happened. He still got up and tried to go again. That's amazing to me.
He had that don't quit mentality and that he shows. And it also at times, I guess this season, I don't know much about him from past seasons, but it also at times makes him come off as aggressive or whiny when he loses.
Totally.
And, you know, he becomes a sore loser. I was just introduced to him this season, you know, coming back into the challenge. And you raved about him a little bit in some of our text messages. And I, you know, I kind of trust your judgment on most things challenge related. So I thought I'd give him a shot. And I really got to like him. They did a good job of this episode of painting him as, and maybe he did this. Of course, he's part of it. It's not like he's an actor, not like a traditional actor. But painting himself as sort of just this quiet competitor, a guy who works out, doesn't say a whole lot unless he loses, and just goes out and gets after it.
That's kind of been his MO the whole time. He's never really fit into a traditional alliance the way that Bananas and Wes were always kind of like had their crews on opposite sides of the game and kind of duked it out. Jordan was savvy enough to keep himself out of elimination. And if he went in, he was probably going to win. So that's if you can play the game that way, not many people do, but he is athletic enough to not fear elimination and to be one of the great all-time final runners. He has that unique combination of, you know, pretty strong, very athletic and endurance for days and smart. So, and I think that's why Bananas and Wes are also great at finals, specifically Bananas. But yeah, it was a good episode. I thought, speaking of being savvy, of having gamesmanship, Bananas figuring out how to not even go into the foam room, that was I also appreciated his nod to maybe the MTV days of yore, like a spring break kind of Club La Vila kind of vibe to that challenge, when otherwise it's been like, you know, they're in the Czech Republic and cold weather, and it's very much not Panama City Beach and it's on spring break. I think they would all be the first to say the show has changed quite a bit. But yeah, no, it was a good episode. I mean, more insanity from Nelson.
That guy, huh?
That guy. It's good stuff. I think they're doing a great job this year. One thing that I really enjoy this go is that even, I mean, Nelson is probably the most unlikable guy or girl on the show. Would you agree with that at this point?
Absolutely.
And last season got so mired down in petty, vindictive, toxic kind of hatred between different characters and resentments and all these kind of things that, and I know this is your first season back, but I'm glad that this timed out to be this season and not the last one, because it was very watchable in like a this is gross kind of way last year, but this is much more just like competition and a little political maneuvering, but not grossly. It's just trying to get people on your side. You know what I mean? It's a pretty clean game so far.
Wes has struck me as he's my villain now. When he helped Dee, I thought that was annoying, but I shrugged it off after about a week and kind of became invested in Wes once more. But now that he, as Bananas put it, gave the cold-hearted nod to put in Jordan, that felt so wrong. Yeah, I know you got to do what you got to do, and you're in there to win.
Yeah, yeah.
That felt cold, as Banana said. But it felt more than cold. It felt villainous.
Yeah, I think they kind of relished that I mean, like you said, you got to do what you got to do. And if you see a chance to take out the reigning champ, you know, and get him, if they're always thinking about the end game, if you're a Bananas or a Wes, you're thinking about who are the other people that I want to run against at the end of this. And you just got to make it that. I mean, everybody's trying to make a final, but they're trying to influence the competition in the final. Oh, that is what the main game is to them. You know, it's not just getting there. It's stacking the competition so that they can win. And so taking Jordan out is a great move. I don't think that they would be afraid of Fessy in a final. Fessy is the kind of guy who gasses out pretty easily, I would think. You know, if it comes to something like go climb this mountain after two other days of strenuous activity, I think they like their chances just due to his size. So I don't know. There's some strategery going on there for sure. It was a good one. Lost in all of this is Bear's demise. You know, he went home too. And I got to admit something. I've kind of developed a soft spot for Bear.
Yeah, me too. Over the last few weeks I have, yeah.
I don't know how you want to analyze his behavior with Kayla, which I try not to do at all, you know? Because, I mean, it's not like...
Pretty unacceptable.
Pretty unacceptable, but I mean, is that, I don't know, that you just get into like the, when this blurs into real world, lowercase real world, like actual reality stuff, I don't know, that this is kind of when I bow out and say like, what is the entertainment value to me on this program? Aside from Jenna and Zach, who I just feel horrible for Jenna. So
yeah,
other than that, it's tough to weigh in too much, but I I'm with you. He was highly entertaining the last few weeks. I've joked that he's like if they had a third Gallagher brother, a younger Gallagher. Noel and Liam had somehow trained this 20-something Bear to go onto the challenge and just be a total prick, but be hilarious. That's been my vibe with him.
Lovable prick.
So I wonder next week if there will be another double elimination for the ladies.
I wondered that too, but they didn't tease that.
They didn't.
The trailer. No.
I don't know. I feel like we're getting very close in terms of the big game narrative to the cutoff point for casually getting these Red Skulls. This was the 8th week of competition. We got to be getting close.
Yeah, I would think so. Jordan, losing Jordan, though, he was, from what I understand from my very limited research, he was the 4th most, what's the phrasing here? He was the 4th winningest monetary from the challenge.
Oh, interesting. So I'm going to guess Ashley was number 1.
Uh-huh.
Bananas was number 2.
I lose it after that. I know 1 and 4 simply because I just knew. I mean, I looked it up and 1 was Ashley. And
I wonder who 3 would be. I wonder who is up above him.
It's newer competitors because the purse has gotten so much bigger than the last few challenges.
And Ashley has held that over Banana's head a few times that, yeah, you've won 6 of these, but I've already won more money than you by winning twice. So I'm pulling for Bananas.
I think I am too. I think he's my guy, and I know that he's not a favorite in the last few years from my understanding, but he might be in the last couple of years, like beyond that, in the past beyond.
I think his transgressions are far enough in the past now. Rivals 3, a lot of people say that's like we've talked about this, kind of the curse of the Bambino on the challenge, if you will, that he took all the money from Sarah and should not have, and he'll never win again, but we'll see. We'll see what happens this year.
So there are just general notes, and we're going to get into the HBO show. I know this much is true, but do you have any thoughts on this news that's been rampant throughout my timeline, my social media timelines, that the Snyder Cut is finally going to see the light of day, the Snyder Cut of Justice League on HBO Max, which, by the way, if you're listening to this on the day it releases on Wednesday, you possibly could have HBO Max. A lot of HBO subscribers will have the ability to get to that. So do you have any thoughts?
I have zero thoughts. I feel like this is, we're missing Donovan right now. I feel like maybe Donovan would have something to say.
Yeah. I kind of do. I thought Justice League was shit. I couldn't believe how it got made. I can't believe how that was the product that they decided to put on the screen.
I have zero thoughts on this.
Okay.
So this is all news to me. What's the idea is that there is a Superior Cut. This is one of those legendary, like, well, you should hear the album that they tried to make before it got cut to pieces by these shitty producers.
Right. So Zack Snyder made Justice League, and he's made a couple of other DC films and films beyond that, mainly of the action or superhero genre. And during the making, toward the end of Justice League, I think his daughter had a just, it was an awful thing happened. I think she killed herself or maybe overdosed. So he had a family emergency and took care of that. And Josh Whedon took over the rest of the film, which I think was just putting it together. I don't know that he did a lot of shooting, although he probably did a little. So what you got in the theaters was a Josh Whedon helmed movie, and fans, these huge DC fans, they're very loud on the internet. They're a loud group of people. They have been clamoring for Zack Snyder's version, and apparently he's put that together. It was rumored to exist, and they're going to put it on HBO Max. It's probably going to be longer. It might fill in some of the blanks. I don't know, but the movie, I don't think, is going to improve just because Zack Snyder re-edits things or adds new stuff to it, because it was the last act that was just horrible CGI, and there's some plot points that are just stupid. Since you're probably not going to watch it, and I don't blame you, it involves some kind of box that, I don't, it's stupid.
You know, for a fan of that genre, which you are, and which I am to a lesser degree, to say that a plot point involving a box that I'm assuming has some control over the narrative is stupid, it's got to be real bad. It's got to be real bad.
Maybe I'm being harsh because DC has just slapped me too many times.
You've been hurt.
I've been hurt. Suicide Squad's maybe one of the worst movies I've seen that with that kind of budget, maybe. Budgets aren't really a matter of movie, how well a movie will be. But anyway, point is, Snyder Cut coming out in I think, the spring on HBO Max. HBO Max is out today as you're listening.
I just got an alert on my phone as you were talking about the Snyder Cut and explaining it to me that HBO Max will be available through my HBO Now subscription. So,
hey, there you go. You'll fire up the Snyder Cut.
And then I'll come back next week brimming with thoughts on the Snyder Cut.
Well, I think that version of Justice League doesn't see the light of the day for a few more months. I think it might be.
Well, later. Maybe I'm getting a super secret HBO Max. HBO Max Max.
Yeah, well, you're the one getting the text messages, not me.
They're just texting me. It's not an alert. It's the HBO president letting me know.
Other thing in our little news, I just want to suggest to everyone listening that What We Do in the Shadows on FX, and you can also watch it on Hulu now that they're partnered, is fantastic this season. I highly recommend that one. So
this is what I've heard.
It's so funny. And the last thing in the sort of news part of the show, have you seen the ads for Perry Mason on HBO?
Only the still for it, like the trailer, you know, as I was flipping through to get to what we're going to talk about next. Mm-hmm. But I meant to click and say, what's going on there? What's happening there? What is happening there?
Well, it's a Perry Mason remake, reboot of starring Matthew Rhys, who's an excellent actor. And it's before Perry Mason becomes a lawyer, even. He's sort of doing investigative work on this crime. That's all I can figure out. It's very noir. So it looks good. I'm sure I'll watch it, and we might even cover it here on the show. So,
well, you know, I don't want to say basically sponsored by HBO, but as close as we can possibly be without actually being sponsored. So
we're stands for HBO.
Obligated to check it out.
I think so. Yeah. Let's get into our HBO show for the week here. I know this much is true, based on the Wally Lamb novel, which I haven't read, just to be clear. The premise is that there's this brother named Dominic, and his twin brother has a very serious mental health issue of schizophrenia, I think. And it's so debilitating that Dominic kind of has to watch over his brother Thomas, played both by Mark Ruffalo. And speaking of people we've reached out to Mark Ruffalo. We didn't hear back from his agent.
Turns out he's a little busy.
Doing what is my question?
Well, who knows?
in the opening scene of the first episode, Thomas has chopped off his right hand in this biblical act. He's claiming he's doing it for reasons from the Bible. And he does this in a public library. And from there, they give you the inciting incident, I suppose, right there in the very first scene. And you get all these sprinkles throughout of their childhood, their younger moments. I know you haven't watched episode 3, but it touches on a couple of young adult kind of moments where they're just a little older. And so you get an idea of what Thomas was like, and you get what's happening to Thomas right after he does this, which he's institutionalized. And Dominic's trying to help his brother get out, mainly, but he's getting stymied at every turn. And the idea here is that Thomas isn't really violent or dangerous, and he has his own psychologist. That's really what the show hinges on in the first episode. And I very briefly mentioned, I guess last week when we decided we were going to dive into the show a little bit, with that it teeters on misery porn.
It does.
But at the same time, you called it a level 2 of fun, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That kind that you, especially that first episode for me, and that it changed a bit in the second episode, but the first I'm like, I'm not enjoying this at all. Like, I'm enjoying it artistically, I guess would be the word. Like, I'm appreciating what's happening on that level, but it is not a pleasure to watch like other things are. But as the story developed and you, especially into episode 2, you start seeing more and more of a complete picture, both in time and information, and the cast expands a bit. I mean, I thought probably the strongest moment in episode 1, when you're really still trying to figure out what this show is about. I mean, it's clear what it's about. It's about these twin brothers and kind of their working through the world and how complex that would be for someone in Thomas's situation. But to me, what really sold episode 1 was Dominic's shift in demeanor when he saw his ex-wife for the first time, Catherine Hahn. Like, it was so bleak up until that moment, and here's like the first what seems like a good solid human being enters the frame. Like, his mom was so lost and gone in so many ways. His stepfather is an okay guy at best, who is only okay because he's been softened with age. His brother is dealing with what he's dealing with. You see this parade of prison guards and cops and all this stuff. I don't know. And then you finally, in episode 2, opens up more onto a richer tapestry of personalities, I guess, that made the mood a lot more tolerable for me.
I was thinking about the book and how it must be an exercise in, let's see how much I can put on one character.
Yeah. I mean, what is his breaking point? I thought opening, you know, I almost thought about the Jordan documentary and how they're revealing all this information. And it's very, you can tell it's a book that is messing with time in a way, and kind of employing zipping back and forth. In episode 2, he closes his eyes. I mean, that's a central theme. I mean, it is one day, right, in his life of trying to get his brother out. Like, he wakes up, and that starts the episode, and he's just so tired that he keeps dozing in and out, and you get little glimpses of the past and who he used to be. You learn things like, yeah, he paints houses now. And in that first episode, he kind of just had the gruff exterior of this New England guy who was blue collar his whole life. And, you know, that's just who he is. And now it comes out that he's been a teacher. He's been married. He's been a father. Just all these things. I don't know. The picture gets a lot richer, I guess.
Let's give everyone a heads up here. We're really going to get into spoilers going forward. So you put father in past tense because episode 2 reveals, am I right about this?
Yeah.
It's this heavy,
awful,
deeply sad moment of he and his wife and their 3-week-old child who dies in the crib from that particular, I forget the name of it, but it was something that all parents worry. Yeah, thank you. Sids, it's something all parents worry about for sure.
And I thought the reveal of him falling asleep just for an instant right at his former brother-in-law's car dealership desk, and all he sees is him and Catherine Hahn in these happy moments, looking at like an ultrasound, those kind of things. And then he's back out. And you know, one, they're not married anymore. Two, there's been no discussion of their child. So something's coming. And then it kind of snowballs that direction. I don't know, the depth that they're going to be willing to go in fully fleshing out these characters is really, the hook has been set after episode two for me, because a story about brothers trying to, or him trying to take care of his brother, that's compelling, but I don't know if it makes a miniseries. But this dude trying to do that on top of carrying all this other stuff is pretty great.
Yes, the big, yeah, he Mark Ruffalo carries the exhaustion so well. You just feel tired for him. He's got to face day to day. It's almost like he's trying to live day to day, because since that accident with his child and his twin brother, Thomas turns that his baby's funeral into like this conspiracy theory. And he kind of shouts, and it's just sad and intense. And he's not only dealing with the loss of his child and obviously the loss of his wife in terms of divorce, but also Thomas, who's each passing day gets deeper into a mental illness that's not being treated very well, obviously.
And they show early on, I guess episode two starts with them going to the Statue of Liberty, and Thomas accidentally locked, they're kids, elementary school age kids, and Thomas accidentally locks himself in the bathroom on this charter bus that the school has rented, and it kind of, they figure out he doesn't know his left from his right. He just can't open the door. And they, once they realize that, they get him out of there. And it just illustrates that this has been his life, Dominic's life, from the get-go. You know, he didn't get to go to the Statue of Liberty once they got there because Thomas was too upset. He had to stay behind with Thomas and the bus driver. Just always pulling at him. I feel like that has been illustrated so well. It's, I don't know. At times, you're right, it is misery porn. It can be tough to watch, but I've been impressed as it's moved along.
As have I. It's it just gives you a intense loss, and it's almost this sadness you feel comforted in. It's weird.
Yeah, I agree with that, because the moments of comfort that he gets are so much more profound because of what they're wrapped up in. You know, like I said, when he saw Catherine Hahn towards the end of the first episode and how much he seemed to take away from that. This time it was when he's speaking to Thomas's psychiatrist, and she mm-hmm. seems to be a source of, or at least attempting to be a source of comfort to him. I mean, those are both such human moments that, you know, I worried that in the first episode that this was going to be the kind of show where you're supposed to be impressed that he's playing both of these twin brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Which I mean, it is impressive when people do that, but it's not really, again, it doesn't make a series for me, like a trick like that. Mm-hmm. So just something where he's fighting the state, the harshness of the state system, that would have been a tough watch, maybe a worthwhile watch, but, and it will continue to be that, but this, I keep saying rich cast of characters, a rich tapestry around him. The more that comes into focus, the more into the show I am.
Right. And then because I imagine he's going to have more loss. It just seems like that kind of show.
You think more loss is coming? You don't think this is a quest for redemption or something like that?
No, I don't. I think this is an examination of burden and grief and shame.
And he's not supposed to get over any of that.
It'll be interesting to see if he does. Again, neither of us have read the novel, so we don't know. So this is a genuine conversation. You talked about how playing two roles doesn't make a show. I do think that, I was trying to figure out, because Ruffalo's facial hair is real, you know? But in the others, when he's playing Thomas, he doesn't have facial hair. So I was trying to figure out the...
how they order. Do all that. Yeah.
Right. And I saw that Ruffalo, if I'm not mistaken, if I've got my order correct, he shot Dominic's scenes all, and then he went and put on a bunch of weight and shot Thomas's scenes.
Okay. I didn't know if that was padding or if that was real or interesting. I will say the times when it's you know, the camera moves fast and they're both in the same room. Those kind of mechanics don't really do it for me. But say in episode two, when psychiatrists suggest that maybe Dominic would feel better if he listened to her session, the taped session that she had with Thomas,
mm-hmm.
him listening to his own voice
mm-hmm.
and reacting to it, and the nuanced differences between Thomas's voice and Dominic's, I thought that was great. And I mean, she even said, "Dominic, you are the control group. You're like the healthy mm-hmm. Thomas."
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a very that's the kind of exploration of this one actor, two roles kind of thing that I enjoy. That makes more sense to me and seems to advance the story a lot more.
And that's a great thing that a show can do that a book cannot.
Yeah, that's true. Something like that would have impact if you're reading it, but that much more so when the voice is the same and you're kind of confronted with this. I've been really impressed with the casting too. It's a lot of folks that maybe, like, I saw that Rosie O'Donnell was going to be in it. Her name was at the start of episode two. And then when she came on screen, I was like, this is great. You forget that she has been in great stuff before. And her character being someone who would tolerate Dominic's outbursts, but only so much, and kind of like read between the lines and still try to help him and warn him before he went on to meet the psychiatrist. You need to chill out a little bit. I don't know. I thought she was very good. That was a welcome surprise, I guess.
She is putting out some real Robert De Niro vibes in this performance.
Interesting. Yeah, I could see it.
Yeah. If you've ever seen Robert De Niro's performance in Copland, there's a mirror going on in this, and it's good. Both of those. Yeah, so... What else you got? Final thoughts on those first couple episodes of this show?
I'm very excited about it. I have no idea where it's going. I mean, obviously, there are plot elements that maybe the characters care about, such as who their father is, you know, that kind of thing. That mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like we all know that at this point, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if Dominic doesn't know that it's his grandfather, if he truly doesn't know, or if he's just thinking like he can't accept it, you know?
Right. I think it is the acceptance thing.
I was surprised that he still brought that up, even though, and I kind of had to like train my mind to realize that all of the shifting around, like when he started the day and he had the new live-in girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
right? That this was a different time than when his mom was dying and what's her name that played the grad student that was translating the paper wasn't in the picture anymore. So all this time movement it's a lot, and they expect you to be able to keep up. And,
mm-hmm.
But I like it when a show respects its viewers enough to dive in with that.
Mm-hmm. Me too. It did take me a minute to do the math on the lady who was translating the text for him.
Right. Yeah. That would have been 2 or 3 years previous to...
I think it was three. I think I did the math and it was like 3 years before.
Yeah. And he's 40 current day. If the current day is him trying to get Thomas out of the psychological penitentiary, that's the current. He's 40 years old. So they do a lot of subtle things, like mention that he was 33 when the baby died. You can slowly kind of put together the timeline,
mm-hmm.
Which you kind of hinted that there are some adolescent age scenes coming, or at least younger scenes. So
yeah, I don't want to ruin too much for you or anyone else who hasn't seen episode 3, but it's college age. So
okay, but it does seem that they're moving on through kind of in a way that again that The Last Dance did, and I don't know. This is kind of the opposite of, you know, normal people. Moved along, but you were supposed to get big lessons about the characters in small moments, and this one is doing the same thing, but you're really getting a much bigger sample size, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to see it come together. I don't know. I'm in. That first episode, I thought I'm gonna keep watching this, but I don't know if I waited to watch episode two almost a full 7 days, and mm-hmm. I won't do that again. I think it's picked up for me.
Yeah, and my opinion of episode 3 is that it does that even more.
Okay.
Yeah, you'll definitely want to watch episode 3, and then you'll be eager for 4.
Yeah, and that's what we'll pick up next week.
I think so. All right, let's take a quick break here. Okay, while we take a break, we'd like to inform you to seek out our website and our other podcasts on thealabamatake.com. The Alabama Take itself, that is a podcast, it's in a separate feed. You've got plenty of time to play catch-up. Corey Hanna sits down with various guests and gets their stories. That show is currently on a break, but we'll be back soon. So there's lots of interesting things to hear on those episodes of the Alabama Take, separate podcast feed. So go ahead and check that out. Also, while we're on a break, let's give a quick shout-out to 87 Jetta. He has been chatting with us online about some things we bring up in the show. So quick shout-out to him. Let's get back into the show. We're back. We're going to talk about this Hulu show called The Great. And we just like the HBO show we just got done talking about, we mentioned it last week and sort of previewed it a little. But the idea of The Great is a very fictionalized romp of Catherine the Great coming into Russia via marriage to Peter III. And it's just playing with history and using a lot of the history of that era to send up, I think, things going on in our era.
I love that word romp. I'm so glad that you got to throw that in, because that's exactly what this is. It's irreverent. It's colorful and pretty action packed. For not that it's an action show, but it stays entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We've enjoyed it. What you hadn't watched it at this point last week, right? What's your impression of it then?
Man, I love it. I love it a lot. It's doing something that's like a flip on some of the things we've talked about on this show. We have really gotten heavily into these 25-minute or 30-minute dramas. That's like been my bread and butter in the last several weeks. This one is like a 50-minute comedy almost.
Yeah.
Which is totally different. And you know it's going to be a send-up. You know it's going to be ridiculous, because you see her carriage arrive in Russia and you think to yourself, okay, well, here come the Russian accents, and no one talks with a Russian accent.
No, not at all.
They're not even pretending to be in Russia, hardly. Not in a unbelievable way, but like you were talking about, it was just irreverent. And Peter III is played by Nicholas Hoult, whom we've mentioned on this show playing Tolkien, right?
Yeah, so it was funny to watch Tolkien and then immediately go into this and just think, my God, JRR is behaving just abysmally after being a pretty stand-up guy last week. I mean, he's just doing God knows what all around the court.
Nicholas Hoult has kind of been maybe pigeonholed as the serious, semi-serious, nerdy guy.
Not anymore.
I
mean, very early on, I mean, I guess we'll go straight into spoilers for at least the first half of the season. You know, there's a balance of how ridiculous he is, but they temper that at times, kind of like a drama may temper a situation with comedy, with how like horrifying the idea of somebody like that having unfettered power is.
Mm-hmm.
That may be related to our current day. I don't know. But things like, say, he gifts Catherine the bear, right? And she loves the bear, and the bear does not have a long shelf life. He shoots the bear pretty early on in court, and is just shown to be just mean, cruel. The whole court society is mean and cruel in ways that are beyond just not accepting Catherine.
And what's great about Nicholas Hoult playing the character Peter III, he is mean and cruel, but still sustains this affability and this hilarity that you do not want to leave his presence much.
No, he's a lot like, I feel like we all knew the frat boy type who was, you know, like his friends are douchebags and he's kind of a douche, but he's also really funny and like a pretty good time. So you like hanging out with him, but you also make sure that he doesn't like find the gun in his closet or something when he gets drunk.
Uh-huh. That's him. Yeah. Men Behaving Badly could have very well been a good title to this show.
I think
it'd actually be a title to another show, but yeah, you can't help but laugh, and it gets funnier and funnier and funnier. It's
much like great comedies do, it takes a minute to build on the jokes it's going to play.
Yeah, and it again, in the background of all of this is Catherine. Maybe the one thing, well, let me ask you this. So at the beginning of this, Catherine is shown to be very idealistic and kind of, well, she remains idealistic, but maybe thinking this marriage to the Russian emperor is going to be a fairy tale kind of story. She even has a picture of what a wedding night is supposed to be like that is just thrown out the window pretty quickly. Do you think her wising up, do you believe the pace at which she does that?
No, I don't believe it, but I do. It serves the show. There's a lot of unbelievable antics going on in this show. So it kind of fits that.
Yeah, that was maybe the worst offense that they had, that she started that episode kind of a starry-eyed schoolgirl almost and finished it like, you know, you can already see, like, I know Catherine knows what she needs to do. She needs to be the Empress of Russia. She needs to take him out.
Okay. So yes, I get you. But at the same time, I think that one of my faults I found with it was when I immediately saw that it wasn't, that plot point wasn't going to be resolved in a couple episodes, that it was going to take the whole 10 before we get there. And I ended up appreciating that after episode 5 or 6 or so, when I just was thinking to myself, I do not want to lose Nicholas Holt. To get rid of him would be a disaster.
I thought the same thing, that surely, you know, especially she kind of assembles her squad, so to speak. Like they're setting the stage for, like, part of this is going to be her learning how to rule. Things go badly, she has to kind of adapt to situations, blah, blah, blah. But that's not the case. And you're right, a few episodes in, you think, well, then we lose Nicholas Holt. And I guess the true story is that he kind of dies mysteriously.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know if they had him killed or if he tried to fight one of his captors or something like that. So maybe they could play with that a little bit. Those Russians just they don't do anything straight up in their history. You know, there's like the Anastasias of the world. I don't know.
So Peter III did die highly likely in a coup type situation, though.
It was definitely a coup, but there's some debate about if he was killed or if he was taken captive and then died of injuries because he like tried to escape and fought somebody, or it's kind of like, it's murky, I guess is what I'm getting at. But I don't know if we're going to dive into all of that. You know, they could have him being held captive for a few episodes. That could be pretty funny.
Just for reference, what episode are you on?
5. So he has just, I went halfway. I didn't know how far you wanted to go through.
No, that's great. I'm actually on, the next time I sit down to watch, I will be on episode 8.
Oh, okay. So
devouring it.
He has just survived the attempt on his life from his jealous best friend. Yeah, that was a very funny, a lot of fart jokes, a lot of, I don't know, that was a good episode. You get a hint of maybe what Catherine would do with power. And she tries not to show how eager she is for it. But all of that was good. I don't know. Yeah. I thought as the episodes have gone on, zero in on who's the funny people to play off of each other, which, I mean, they knew from the beginning because this was all produced. It wasn't like they were like, it wasn't an ongoing production. You know what I mean? Where they kind of grew into roles, but I don't know. It's good stuff.
I found the show at first to be a bit repetitious, but still enjoyable, of course, or else I wouldn't have kept on. There, you do find a groove to the show, and it actually took me a few, and I don't want to be the kind of person who says that it's the show that you got to give 3 episodes. It's not quite like that, but it did take me personally a few episodes to conclude. It's not a very hyperactive show in terms of what it wants to accomplish. It's almost episodic in that manner.
Yeah, it doesn't, that's well said. Like, I don't feel like it's in a rush to do anything except be, you know, like the major accomplishment for an episode may just be that the women of the court begrudgingly accept Catherine a little bit more. And that's all that happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a Russian court Seinfeld in a way, you know? I mean, it's going to end in a coup, but
yeah.
Other than that.
It, to me, it gives the it helps establish the idea that things that really do need to change for the better are often happening at such a glacial pace.
Until they happen all at once. I don't know. And there's some interesting commentary, serious commentary at moments from, say, Peter's aunt, you know, who is kind of a seasoned veteran of the court scene, saying things like, it's easier, you know, she's smarter than she lets on to the public of the court. And more, I guess our 2020 term will be woke, but she kind of hides all of that, and they think she's just weird and crazy. It's
right.
her method of survival while she coaches Catherine through this adjustment period.
Exactly. Right. Then, so I'm going to offer up this, and you agree or disagree or land wherever. I think this may be the best piece of satire on the Trump administration as we've gotten in a while.
I mean, there's been a lot of like the plot against America. We kind of beat that into the ground. But that wasn't satire. It's all taken on a very dark, dramatic tone. Yeah, I mean, I can't think of many that are using comedy to cut.
So the plot against America was more of almost an allegory, though we talked about how it wasn't a one-for-one. This is more of a satirical piece, and I thoroughly think this is a takedown of the Trump administration. I really do.
Yeah, and I think that, I don't know, maybe this gets made at any time, but it definitely has more fodder readily available in terms of, would people actually act like this? And then you turn on the news and you think, yeah, they are, or they would.
And let me just throw out some examples of why I came to this conclusion. So we get the men acting badly. We get frat house antics in a place of high order, supposed to be high order. We get Peter the Third, who thinks everyone loves him, but actually everybody hates him. Okay.
I'm going to be very vulnerable here on the podcast. Have I ever told you about the dream that I had about Trump?
I was
backstage at an event like that, I guess a band that I'm in was playing, and he was there for some reason, like just hanging out waiting to speak, and he was alone. I don't know why I started talking to him, but he said something like, I don't understand why these people don't like me. I mean, you like me, right? Like, no. And he is just, what it was, not cognitive dissonance, but confirmation bias. He just assumed that everyone else liked him. And I just remember like someone telling me, you have to go play music now, and like turning around and looking, and he was just like staring at his shoes, almost crying. That's the only time Trump has been in my dreams, thank God. But
that's a very Peter from the show. It's a very Peter reaction, right?
Yeah, which is totally what you think at the end of the day. Like, just please like me.
We get his best friend, Gregor, that you mentioned earlier. And one thing we didn't get to mention was that Peter's sleeping with Gregor's wife very openly. Gregor knows this and is supposed to approve of it. And then Gregor turns around and he's the one who actually poisoned him that you brought up in episode 5. He's got all these people around him who's supposedly not going to turn on him. And yet they can't kill him or don't want to because he could also help them, right? He could move them up in status.
Right. There's people who have problems with him, and it's said a few times, if we can just kind of stomach his personality, everything else is fine. Like our life couldn't get better by like removing him.
You tell me another more Trumpian statement than that.
No, that's it. That's absolutely it. Just kind of turning a blind eye he's literally screwing your wife, but life is pretty good. You're at the palace.
And I think there might be an exact quote from Nicholas Holt's Peter, where he says, everyone loves me, when he's thinking about when he got poisoned.
How could this happen? Everybody loves me.
Right.
That's exactly what Trump would say, you would think.
We just need Trump going around saying huzzah and crashing glasses on the floor constantly.
Oh, maybe Trump would be a more effective leader if he did drink as much as they seem to in the Russian court.
Uh-huh. Well, I'd also love, this is absolutely tangential, but I love it when Peter says touche, or he pronounces touche as touche.
there's a lot of good little jokes like that.
Just a bumbling idiot. Now, I'm telling you, man, I think this show was written about the Trump administration. How many times has Trump said something that was absolutely mispronounced?
Yeah, yeah. That's got to be it. Just supreme privilege. But also, you know, not only we talked about maybe the point of the satire is the moments where it's not funny, like when he kills the bear, or say like when the military assembles and he wants to like fist fight the guy, right? Who's laughing at him. He just stabs him instead. Mm-hmm. Just brutally murders him in front of everybody else, which is like, you're laughing. And I was kind of laughing during the scene, but I don't know. It does a good job. It is a comedy, but those moments of like, yeah, that's exactly what it's like when someone out of control has power like that.
Yes. And in a couple of episodes from where you are, you're going to start seeing some more dichotomies in battle, like some science versus religion stuff that's coming down the pike. And I'm going to give you this one line, which taken out of context, it's like rather meaningless, but I still love it. There's a line from the show, I think in episode 7, where it said, "Stop crying unless you're looking at art." So there you, that might be the summation of the show right there.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. All right. I'm real glad you suggested this show, though. Another good example of what we like to cover here. There's a lot of meat to it. We might do a quick wrap up on this one. So folks, if you've made it this far, watch The Great on Hulu. It's worth your time. Give the show a moment to establish itself, and then I think you're in for a good ride. So that's it for this week. We're going to be back Tuesday. We are a day late because of Memorial Day, but we'll be back on Tuesday with another show. Until then, stay at home as much as you can. Keep yourself and everyone else safe, okay? We'll talk to everyone later.